reach the
Welcome to the show. My name's Dave, and this is another very special episode of Fistful Podcast from fistfulpodcast.com, yada, yada, yada. I want to get past all that because I've got someone very important and very exciting on the show today. So, the average listener who's casually acquainted with the show will know that I've been able to snag some really awesome paleontologists. This is no exception. For this bonus episode, I have the paleontologist who studied and got to name the new ankylosaur Zool. Lots to talk about, so please, boy oh boy, I don't know where, I always get starstruck at these moments. So I have Victoria Arbor on the show. Thank you for joining me, Victoria.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me.
I gotta tell you, I so far done two or three of these, and I'm starstruck every time, and I'm trying to work over it.
No, don't be starstruck.
I can't help it. Like if you're a dinosaur fanboy like yours truly here, when Andy Farkey brought up your name, he's like, "Oh, you should interview Victoria." I was like, "Oh, she'll never want to be on a show like this."
Oh no. Oh.
That's just my own self-esteem issues. But getting more to the point, Victoria, you're a paleontologist in Canada.
That's right.
Let's start with some of the specifics about yourself. At what age did you find yourself attracted to dinosaurs?
I can't even remember because it goes back as far as I can remember. Mm-hmm. I was just one of those little kids that really, really liked dinosaurs. I used to talk about dinosaurs with my doctor, my like family doctor, whenever we would go in. He had this like poster in his really? Office and we would always like talk about it. My parents are always like, "She knows every dinosaur." And I think I was one of those like slightly insufferable tiny children that just really, really liked dinosaurs. And then I just never really grew out of that phase. So now I get to be like an insufferable 30-something who knows a lot about dinosaurs. So I guess it worked out pretty good.
Yeah, I can identify with you there, except I didn't have the drive to get the education.
Well, I'm very stubborn. So it's really that's the main thing that has to carry you through some of this, I think, is to just be like really stubborn, like forever.
Yeah, I'm sure. Second question, Victoria, is that the most annoying question you get asked? Like, how did you get into dinosaurs? I'm sure everybody asks it, and I have
no,
to.
No, I think it's a great question. Like, I think it's really interesting to hear about how people come to their professions. And like, to me, being a paleontologist is really normal now. But I mean, for a lot of people, it's like a thing you hear about, but you don't necessarily know a lot of people doing it. I mean, I know a lot of people doing it because like, that's right. All my friends.
Right.
But no, so I think it's a great question. Like, I always love hearing about how other people in totally different jobs came to be in their careers. So I don't think it's a bad question at all.
You're obviously much more compassionate than most people, because I don't think I could take the same question day after day like that.
Well, the question that I really get asked most of the time is, who would win in a fight, T-Rex versus Spinosaurus? And I'm like, I don't study those dinosaurs. Don't ask me that question.
I love hypotheticals like that, because it really shows that like people are so disconnected to dinosaurs. They just want to pluck them out of every time period and put them in a jar and shake them up and see what happens.
Yeah, even that's not a bad question. But that's the actual question that I'm always like, all right, let's do this.
I think the origin story of most paleontologists is roughly the same. It's like, I was three or whatever tiny age, dinosaurs, and it just sort of stuck. You never hear, or at least I have not yet heard, a story of a paleontologist who was like, "Oh, you know, I was in my mid-20s and I was like, what are these, dinosaurs? And the rest is history."
I do know several of my colleagues like didn't really get into paleontology until they were in their undergrad degrees. And took courses in like evolution or biology or earth sciences, especially, and realized that they were actually like interested in pursuing that as a career, not just as kind of like, oh, that's like kind of interesting stuff. So there are those people out there. And I mean, especially if you work on things other than dinosaurs, like I don't know a lot of kids who grow up being like, "I really want to study osteostracans when I grow up," but right. Then I have a friend who studies them and it's really cool work. So I mean, I think like I get a little bit of a pass because I work on dinosaurs, but there's definitely like so much more out there than just dinosaurs. So
oh, I yeah. know. I I have the same thought occurring, and I brought it up to Andy Farkey. Like, I don't know what it is about the superfauna of the Eocene and the Miocene. It's just they did not take off, man.
There's cool stuff, though. And that's why it's so fun to teach paleontology courses. Like, I've taught, like courses where we've done, like, mammal paleontology, and it's really fun because, like, you get to start with, like, familiar things like dinosaurs, but then you get to sort of reveal all this sort of insider knowledge to people about things that aren't as well known. And yeah, you never know if you're going to sort of inspire the next person who's going to go on and make the Miocene really big. So that would be cool.
Yeah, we're still waiting for the Miocene to break wide open. It just hasn't captured the hearts and minds
of the
public.
Maybe that'll be the top trend for 2018.
Oh, fingers crossed. Although not really, because I don't want to see dinosaurs go anywhere.
Well, they'll be classic. They'll be like the little black dress. Like, they'll always be there. But then but then the Miocene is going to be really big.
We can only hope.
Yeah. I think it'll be big in the fall.
So, fall colors, Miocene. Oh, man. So Victoria, you are a specialist in ankylosaurs, right?
Yeah, I seem to keep coming back around to these guys all the time. So I'm fine with that. I really like them. So they're a great group to work on. And I'm not like the only person studying these dinosaurs, obviously, but it wasn't as packed full as, say, like feathered dinosaurs or tyrannosaurs or things like that when I started my master's about 10 years ago. So it was just nice. There was lots of space to sort of stretch out and ask new questions and try to solve some problems that hadn't been solved before. And I keep like ending up with new questions every time I write a paper, basically. So I think that's worked out pretty good.
Yeah, I'd say so. Well, and here's the thing about ankylosaurs, and I'll even group stegosaurs and other big land animals that aren't your, like, I don't know even what to say, because if you go to any person on the street, whether they know about dinosaurs or not, they can tell you at least a couple facts about Triceratops, at least a couple facts about the horned dinosaurs, etc. But by and large, even I, as a dinosaur fanboy, probably could not tell you a wild amount of information about ankylosaurs.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I'm always surprised because people will come up and be like, oh, those were my favorite dinosaurs when I was a kid. And I usually just explain, like, those are the ones with, like, the club tails. Some of them have club tails, at least. So lots of people, they were, like, one of the favorites. And they're still some of the, like, classic dinosaurs. Like, a lot of people know about, like, Ankylosaurus or whatever. But there just hasn't been the same sort of concerted, like, effort by lots of people all at the same time, like there has been for some of the other, like, especially for, like, the predatory dinosaurs and feathered dinosaurs. And that makes sense. I mean, those were important things to study, like, for sure. But it's nice that it's just nice to be able to, like, help contribute to, like, other groups that maybe weren't as appreciative or appreciated by the general public, and slowly change that.
Yeah, if you're not a T-Rex, I can't see many, like, plebs or normal people out there really getting the information that they, because I mean, T-Rex is everywhere. You can find it on a shirt for a 3-year-old, you can find it on a sippy cup, or you can find it in the movies. With ankylosaurs and their ilk, fascinating, even just a glance. They look amazing, super fascinating. You want to learn more about them, but they're so little readily available, I guess, to the common person. Because even when I was doing tertiary research for the show to try and brush up on my ankylosaur knowledge, very little out there aside from, like, the top 10 lists of, like, oh, wow, you know, they got this big, they were that fat, they had this on their tail, they were of this family.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the challenges with ankylosaurs is that they're a little bit, I mean, all dinosaurs are hard to study. Like, nothing's, like, easy, really, I guess. But they're a little bit challenging to study because they're hard to reconstruct. So they look really cool, like, exactly what you were saying. Like, the armor makes them look, like, really rad, right? But the problem is that the armor is, like, never preserved in place. So it's really hard to get a good picture of what they look like a lot of the time. And, like, with some of the recent discoveries, obviously, that's starting to change, like, a little bit. But so there's lots of species where we're kind of, like, using a lot of, like, educated guesses and inference to really reconstruct what they look like. And so I think a lot of artists are a little bit leery to reconstruct them and put them in their like pop sci mm-hmm. books. And it's just harder to like piece together their biology and anatomy. When this really characteristic part of their bodies just like falls away right. like instantly as soon as they die. So, I think that's one of the big challenges with them.
So let's start from square one, then we'll build up to Zool, because I don't want to go over the top too soon. But ankylosaurs, when is the first? What is the first? I guess I'm trying to discern their lineage. How far do ankylosaurs go back that we can trace?
Yeah, it's a good question. So most of the really good fossils are from the Cretaceous period. Mm-hmm. But there are some more fragmentary specimens from the Jurassic, and I think the oldest one is about Oxfordian, so I think that's Middle Jurassic. I don't work in the Jurassic very much, so I'm probably getting that wrong, and then they'll have to revoke my PhD. Right. But yeah, so there's a really interesting jaw that probably is an ankylosaur because it has some of the ornamentation on the jaw that we see in ankylosaurs and not stegosaurs. Mm. And it's from the UK, and it's really fun because it's actually called Sarcolestes, which means like flesh lover, because the teeth are kind of pointed, and I think they must have originally been interpreted as like a predator's teeth, even though it's from an ankylosaur. Right. And it's like a tooth type we would consider like a plant eater's teeth now. So that's one of the really earliest ones, but it's just this jaw fragment. So we don't know a whole lot about the rest of the body or it, like anything really about this particular ankylosaur. But so we know that ankylosaurs were around like pretty much from the beginning of when a lot of major dinosaur lineages started to like split apart from each other and diversify. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and then there's some really great specimens from the Morrison Formation. There's an animal called Gargoyleosaurus, and there's one called Mimoropelta that are both known from pretty good specimens. Gargoyleosaurus has a really nice skull, which is great. Right. And so those guys would have been living around like Stegosaurus, but they're just a lot more rare. So Stegosaurs were kind of like those two groups. So Stegosaurs and Ankylosaurs are in a group called Thyreophora, the armored dinosaurs, and they share osteoderms, those like armor plates in common. Mm. So there were places where both of those major groups lived together, but then for some reason Stegosaurs seemed to sort of peter off in the early Cretaceous period. And then it's ankylosaur world all the way to the end.
So now I'm looking at pictures of the ankylosaur teeth now that you've mentioned, stegosaurs. So the teeth of these things look like, they're ripping up small bits of vegetation off the ground. And I know that stegosaurs are one of the few dinosaurs that we have conclusive proof that used gastroliths. As far as ankylosaurs, were they employing such things?
That is a good question. So there's not a lot of specimens that have gut contents preserved just because there's not a lot of specimens that are articulated at all. Mm-hmm. The new specimen that was collected by the Terrell Museum that was also publicized the same week as Zool, mm-hmm. It's a nodosaur, so it's from the other group of ankylosaurs that doesn't have a tail club, and I believe that that one has gastroliths preserved in its belly. And then there's a specimen from Australia of a really weird ankylosaur called Minmai. Now it has a new name. It's called Kunbarosaurus, okay. Which is a great name. I love it. and it's a beautiful articulated specimen, and it has gut contents, and I can't recall if it has gastroliths. I'd have to look that up, but it also has sort of like plant remains in its belly with or without coprolites. So, yeah, so it seems like at least a few of them might have used gastroliths or stomach stones, but maybe not all of them.
Okay, so moral of the story is it's still kind of spotty since our record of the ankylosaurs is still kind of sparse?
Yeah. I think more information needed.
Is there a certain species that has more specimens than others? Because I know with T-Rex, there's 20-plus skeletons around the world. How many complete or semi-complete or mostly complete, rather, specimens of ankylosaurs do we have?
That's a good question. So it's hard for me to put an exact number on it, but I can tell you a bit about like where good places to find ankylosaurs are and which species we know the most about.
Okay.
So some of the best places to find ankylosaurs are actually in Alberta and Western North America. And another place that's really good to find them is Mongolia, but they're preserved in really different ways. So in Alberta and Utah and New Mexico, we tend to find them as like isolated skulls or sort of like partially articulated specimens or things that have been kind of dissociated, but it's all like jumbled up in an area. That's because a lot of these fossils are preserved in rivers and, or like ancient rivers, ancient streams. So they've had a little bit of like water moving them around, or maybe they've been partially scavenged. In Mongolia, a lot of the ankylosaurs and a lot of the dinosaurs just in general were actually living in a desert, duney environment, and a lot of the skeletons are preserved completely articulated in like a crouched posture with the head reaching upwards, and we think this means they were entombed while they were alive the dunes collapsing on them, and so they're actually like trying to like strain to get their heads out, and it's really sad. But yeah, it's pretty grim, but great also for us.
Right.
So it's a little complicated when you start studying these things sometimes. And so Mongolia is a really great place to find specimens with the armor articulated, but sometimes they've been really chewed up by bugs, like ancient bugs have sort of bored into them and eaten the bones up a little bit. So you can have these specimens that are really nicely preserved with all of the armor in place, but then there's all these like holes and like chewed up parts of them from like little burrowing bugs that like got in and like ate into the carcasses while they were buried. So we know a lot about the dinosaur or the ankylosaur called Panakosaurus, which is found in Mongolia, sometimes in little clusters where they're all kind of snuggled up next to each other as kind of like juveniles or teenagers. But we basically don't have any adult Panakosaurus, which is very inconvenient. So it's like we have all these juveniles and like no adults that we could really confidently assign to that species. So that is weird and frustrating.
Yeah.
For me, at least.
Right.
Meanwhile, over in North America, we've got a pretty good sample size of an animal called Euoplocephalus, which is one of the ones that we have the most specimens of. We've got lots of skulls for that particular species. But at this point, since I revised that genus to take a lot of beastless specimens out of it and put them over in different species, we now don't really have a nice articulated specimen of Euoplocephalus. So we've got like lots of information, but not all put together for that particular animal. So so we have kind of like these, and those are all mostly like large adults and no juveniles. So we've got kind of like good information in different ways in different places.
Yeah, Mongolia is a strange place for fossil collecting anyway, because of the completeness of an articulation of the specimens over there. Like one of the most famous, obviously, is the Protoceratops Velociraptor combo, where they were locked in battle and probably covered over by a dune.
Right.
And it's interesting to see that over there, because over here with the bigger bones, you really have to luck out that they fell into a stream or were covered by a flood or something. But with the dunes, all you had to do was like have a big wind and flop.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a totally different environment and a totally different way to preserve the fossils that we just don't really seem to have had in North America at that time period. So yeah, so you just end up with these really different kind of like preservational modes and the kinds of things that can get preserved. Just by having like the different paleo environments in the different places.
Now, I'm seeing another parallel, or maybe there's another parallel, between stegosaurs and ankylosaurs, in that they seem to be, at least to me, solitary animals, the ankylosaurs. We don't find a lot of them in bone beds like centrosaurs or all the hadrosaurs. So were they typically lone species?
Yeah, it's not something that I've really like written about yet, but I mean, myself and a couple of our colleagues kind of figure that probably as adults, they were solitary for the most part. The only times that we really get accumulations of more than one ankylosaurid, at least, so the tail-clubbed ones, are in Mongolia, where we have those groups of juveniles.
Right.
And sometimes there can be a lot of juveniles all together. So it's really interesting, because maybe the juveniles were hanging out together as they were growing and developing their armor, and then they became more solitary as they were adults. So this is something that we're still working on, and we would like to have more information about. But that seems to be what happens, because we don't really find a lot of adults at all. The juveniles are in little clusters over there. And then in North America, we basically only ever find them by themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting, the more that I look into it, the more, and I'm trying to get more information on stegosaurs also, but that's for another time.
Yes. Yeah, they're a whole group with their own quirks too, that's for sure.
So as far as ankylosaurs go, now here's something that a lot of people I think misunderstands. When you say you have an ankylosaur, they think of a single species, but ankylosaur refers to the family, right?
Yeah, that's right. So it gets really the way that like naming groups of animals works is really confusing because you're supposed to use like similar words with like different endings for the group that you're working on. So ankylosauria is the group that includes all ankylosaurs. So when I say ankylosaurs, I'm referring to sort of like the biggest group imaginable. So that's every ankylosaur species. Right. And then that's divided into two big groups. One group is called ankylosauridae, and the other group is called nodosauridae. And so the ankylosaurids are the guys that eventually have a tail club. So not every ankylosaurid has a tail club, but if it has a tail club, it's an ankylosaurid. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, the nodosaurids kind of go off and do their own interesting things, and they have their own interesting adaptations. So they never evolve a tail club, but they often get these really big shoulder spikes that are really cool and really interesting. So they sort of like front load themselves, and then ankylosaurids kind of weaponize the very end of their body, which is pretty interesting. And then we can sort of subdivide things more or less. There's some argument about whether there's a third group called the polacanthines that have this kind of fused up sacral area. The work that I've done suggests that those might just be like early nodosaurs, but I'm certainly open to them being like another group if we get more information. And then we can subdivide the ankylosaurids into the ones that definitely have tail clubs, and those are the ankylosaurines. So it all gets a little bit confusing, but mostly for today, I'm just talking about like ankylosaurids versus nodosaurids, so tail clubs versus not tail clubs,
right? And that's a thing that I've come to find, because when I'm talking with Andy Farkey, we have ceratopsians, ceratopsids, and so many ways of looking at the same group of animals. But when you said shoulder spikes, that brought something to mind. So is, now going back as far as like the Triassic, possibly, I think I might be wrong on that, but the Desmodosuchus, is that still in the same lineage?
Oh, no. So that's really interesting, because those guys are not related at all to ankylosaurs. So armored body forms come up over and over again in evolutionary history. So Desmatosuchus is something called an aetosaur. I've heard some people say aetosaur, so I might be saying it incorrectly, but I'm going to say aetosaur because I can't change at this point.
Right.
And so those guys are actually related, more closely related to crocodiles than to dinosaurs. So they're on the like Pseudosuchian or Kurotarsan lineage, whichever one you want to call it. So that's the group that includes modern day crocodiles, the Rauisuchian, so like these big predators, just all kinds of other, like there's a whole diversity of like crocodile relatives that flourished in the Triassic, and then dinosaurs kind of take over in the Jurassic period. So yeah, so these guys are really cool because you're right. They have like these really cool big shoulder spikes. They look a lot like nodosaurs, but they're more closely related to crocodiles. So they're not close to ankylosaurs at all.
Yeah, and it's interesting that so many broad range of species develop similar types of defense, because legitimately, if you did take the shoulder spikes off Desmodosuchus, it would look like a weird stretched out crocodile, essentially.
Yeah, they're very crocodile looking. And even once you start to get familiar with the different kinds of armor that's out there, so I'm going to call them osteoderms from here on out. So that just means skin bone.
Right.
And they're like these bones that form in the skin. You also see them in like armadillos and stuff. And so that's the bone that creates that armor spiky like sort of the armor plating basically in ankylosaurs and also in crocodiles. And so crocodile osteoderms tend to have sort of a more squarish base, and they've got this really like distinctive pitting on the top surface. And it's really easy to tell them apart from ankylosaur osteoderms if you're finding them like in the same fossil deposits. Mm-hmm. So even though they both have armor, even the way the armor is formed and the textures it has are really distinct between those two groups. So they sort of, yeah, they're sort of like doing their own thing, even though overall they look kind of similar.
Yeah, because there's definitely a more armored dinosaurs than you could even think. Because if you think armored dinosaurs, you're thinking ankylosaur and their lineage. But there are so many out there that are these weird offshoots that aren't related but are strikingly similar. And if you didn't take the time to look, you could say, oh, well, here's, you know, we're seeing signs of this hundreds of millions of years before the modern quote-unquote ankylosaur.
Right, yeah. So there's lots of different groups of animals evolve armor and osteoderms. It's found in things like Scutosaurus, which is like a really weird like thing in the Permian that's not closely related to anything. We see them in crocodiles. So like lots of crocodiles have osteoderms. So the Adasaurs are definitely the ones that are like the most armored, but today's crocodiles also have osteoderms and armor plates in their skin too. Armadillos and glyptodonts have osteoderms, ankylosaurs have osteoderms, and then there's even a couple of other groups of dinosaurs outside the armored dinosaurs, quote-quote, that evolved osteoderms too. So, like, some of the sauropods have osteoderms, and they are really weird and bizarro and huge, right. And I'm just like, where are you getting the minerals to make this in your body? Because it's like giant boulders in their skin. It's just bizarre. Yeah, so it's something that comes up over and over and over again in evolutionary history.
Well, so here's a question that I've had rolling around my brain for a while. So most information that you find out about these giant dinosaurs is they're eating a lot of this nutrient poor plant matter. But is there something that points to that it was very nutrient poor? Because like, let's back to the ankylosaurs. You have to have a lot of minerals to build up those osteoderms, the bone club, all of these specialized structures. So do you think that it was as nutrient poor as it seems or appears in like popular culture, at least, or were there different sources they were getting these minerals from, in your opinion?
I think it's a really interesting question. It's hard to know exactly. So, I mean, obviously, it's hard to know exactly what they were eating, and it's even harder to know, like, the nutritional, like, right. content. Like, I don't know the nutritional content of the food I eat. It's probably, like, horrendous, really. But, like, trying to, like, figure that out for ancient animals is just super duper hard. But there's sort of increasingly sort of a couple of my colleagues and I are sort of swirling around the idea of ankylosaurs maybe eating things other than just leaves. So not necessarily being omnivores all the way, but maybe they incorporate a little bit more insect into their diet than we might expect. Maybe they're eating like tubers or fruits or just something other than just leaves, because they've got these weird mouths, they've got weird teeth, they've got weird noses and snouts that sort of point towards they're doing something different with their feeding habits. And even last fall, there was a paper published on a little ankylosaur from China that had fish in its gut, sort of like stomach cavity. So I am a little bit skeptical of it being piscivorous or a like dedicated fish eater.
Right.
And I'd like to see some more specimens that have that. But it's definitely interesting. So there's kind of like a lot of weird evidence. They've got like these really big bones that help anchor the tongue in their like sort of in their throat that we don't really see in other dinosaurs. They've got this weird like divided oral cavity where like one of the bones comes down like all the way to the tooth row and kind of splits it into two compartments. They just have really weird heads, basically.
Right.
And so it's not like super clear cut like it is with, say, hadrosaurs or ceratopsians, where they've got like these obvious like grinding teeth for grinding up plants. So maybe ankylosaurs are eating something a little bit different from ceratopsians and hadrosaurs, and maybe they're just utilizing different food sources than we might expect from just something that eats leaves and ferns. It's possible that they might be getting some of the things they need for calcium and sort of like bone formation in their skin that way. But I'm not even really sure exactly what the nutritional needs are of modern day animals with osteoderms. So that's, my hunch is that probably no one has looked at that, because I think it would be hard to do. So if anyone here is listening and is like a metabolic physiologist for like crocodiles, maybe go do a project on how they make osteoderms.
Yeah, please write in. I would love to.
Yes.
And I realize that that question is almost impossible to answer, but I can't help but think with all of these giant animals roaming around eating this vegetation, there's got to be something more to it than that. And even looking, like, let's say at the ankylosaur skull, a lot of them sort of are shovel-shaped.
Yeah, so the notosaurids tend to have what I would consider a more stegosaur-like skull. They're obviously different, but they've got sort of a longer snout, sort of narrow beak at the front, something that you might sort of assume is like a little bit pickier eater, like choosing its food selectively. Ankylosaurids, on the other hand, they start off with those kind of long snouts too, but by the time you get to the very end of the Cretaceous and you've got like the big radiation happening in Asia and North America, they've got these really weird like squat skulls where like everything's kind of been smushed back together. So they've got these weird broad snouts and a big wide beak, short jaws, like everything's short and sort of smushed in together. So something happened, like that doesn't just happen like randomly. Something that's obviously in response to some change in how they're approaching getting their food, that we just don't know yet. So I think it's really interesting trying to figure some of these things out.
So in those skulls, are all of those teeth those sort of weird, like pine cone, for lack of a better term, shaped teeth? So they have nothing to grind with?
So here's what's really interesting. So ankylosaur teeth look a little bit like if you take your hand and you open up your palm and you sort of stick all your fingers together, that kind of looks like an ankylosaur tooth. So it's kind of like a little leaf with little dentic, like little prongs coming off of the side. So they look like leaves and they probably eat plants, like at least as the bulk of what they're eating. So they're also super tiny. So in like ankylosaurus, it is just ridiculous because the head is like huge. It's like the size of a wood pallet, basically. It's an entire pallet sized head, and the teeth are like 4 millimeters tall or something ridiculous. Like they're really tiny, like it's really dumb. And they're not a lot bigger proportionately in like the like slightly smaller ankylosaurs either. So my hunch is that they were probably gradually evolving their teeth away, and those teeth are like, you know, give them another like 10 million years and maybe they wouldn't have teeth.
Weird.
But even when their teeth are really tiny and they look like they can't possibly really be doing that much, they will wear them all the way down. So those perfect like leaf-shaped teeth will just be like little smooth nubs by the time they fall out of their face and get replaced with a new one. So they're grinding them down, eating something, but what those things are, we don't know.
So, but they did have replenishing teeth.
Yeah, so there's always teeth coming in and replacing them. I don't recall exactly how quickly they're replacing them, but I think it's a little bit slower than what we see in ceratopsians or hadrosaurs, which are grinding them down really quickly. Mm-hmm. So they're still replacing them. They're still wearing them out, like, and then replacing them with fresh ones. But they're just so tiny and strange. It's kind of a mystery to me. I'm like, why are you doing it this weird way? What are you eating?
Self-replicating teeth like a lot of the dinosaurs have, I feel like that's a jackpot. That's like a lottery winning hand if you can constantly push new teeth out.
Oh, it just seems like so much better. Like, can you imagine how different our lives would be?
I always think, what a ripoff. We did not get teeth. Like, because even like sharks have them, all these dinosaurs have them. There are so many animals that don't have to worry about breaking a tooth or getting something stuck under there and maybe like losing a jaw to like an infection.
True.
These guys had that covered.
Yeah, mammals really are the weird ones out. Like, it's an evolutionary innovation that just kind of isn't actually that convenient for us, but it obviously does something. So
it's a real letdown as far as I'm concerned.
Our dentists would look really different if we didn't do teeth the way we did today.
Yeah, I imagine a lot of the tools just be replaced with pliers.
Oh, gross.
Because they're like, well, you know, you got another one behind there. We'll just get rid of this bad one.
That one's no good. Take it out.
Right. So again, like looking at the skull, the pretty big heads on these guys. What do we know about their brain cavity, like their capacity up there? What's going on in their heads?
So probably not a lot, unfortunately. So in a really big euoplocephalus skull or in Zool's skull, which like I could sort of like, if I put my arms out and make sort of like a, I could sort of like hug it. That's about the size that their heads are. The brain would fit in like the palm of my hand. So they're not super smart dinosaurs.
Right.
But that's okay. You know, and there's still a lot we don't know about how brain size corresponds to intelligence and what do we really mean when we say intelligence? Like, are we talking about like, you know, problem solving like parrots and crows and humans and dolphins do. But, you know, lots of animals aren't that smart and they get along just fine.
Right.
So there's still a lot we don't know about, like, what it really means to be smart. So anyway, Ankylosaur is probably not, like, the super smartest of the dinosaurs, but still getting along well enough for millions and millions of years. So they've got pretty good olfactory lobes, so they probably had, like, a pretty decent sense of smell. They're not, like, huge or anything, but they're, like, okay. Mm-hmm. And another weird thing about ankylosaurs is you look at their heads, and they look really solid and boxy and heavy, right? Like, because they don't have all the, like, openings that, like, the theropod dinosaurs do. They've kind of closed up a lot of those, like, fenestrae, the skull windows. Right. Or they've tucked them away and hidden them. And then they've got all this armor sort of covering up parts of the skull bones or sculpturing the skull bones. So they look like they're super heavy and solid, but they're actually mostly full of air. So some of the work that Larry Whitmer has done and his students has been to look at the inside of ankylosaur heads, and what they found was that the inside of the nasal passage, you know, from the nostril back to, like, you know, where it would enter, like, the trachea, isn't just like a straight path. It's like a crazy straw. So it, like, loops around in this crazy, like, looping pattern. And it's just really weird. So basically, like, if you cut an ankylosaur, like, through the snout, you just see all these little circular channels through it. And those represent parts of the airway that's, like, looping around back on itself.
So that, this may be a stupid question, but is that in any way related possibly to, like, the Parasaurolophus crest? Maybe they were using those channels to resonate some sort of sound?
Well, that's one of the things that we've looked at. And so some of the other work that we've done has looked at the vascularization, so the blood vessels in the nasal passages, because there's some really beautiful specimens that are broken in a convenient way where we can look at the top of those passageways. And we can see, like, impressions for the blood vessels. And so they were highly vascularized, which could mean a couple of things. It could mean that they're using the nose for thermoregulation, so for shedding heat or for retaining heat, but probably more likely shedding heat that's going towards the brain, because they have big bodies and they live in hot environments. They could be using them for osmoregulation, so that's water regulation, so keeping, you know, if you sort of breathe through your nose versus your mouth, you get, like, your mouth gets all parched and dry and right. You, like, lose water a lot more quickly. But if you're breathing through your nose, like, you're sort of not losing water as quickly. So it could be a little bit related to that, or it could be related to sound production, like we see in the hadrosaurs, so maybe they're honking a little bit. So we can't really distinguish between those three possibilities right now, and it's probable that, like, all of those things are at play, but it's really, really weird. It's a very weird thing to have evolved, and we don't really know why.
Like,
why would you do this? Again, a lot of the time I just sit there and I'm just like, why are you doing this weird thing, ankylosaurs? But it's great because then you get to study it, but it is really weird. So
that sort of raises another question that is not entirely related to ankylosaurs. But so back in the, you know, Jurassic and Cretaceous, the Earth was obviously a little hotter than it is today.
Right.
Which is still why a lot of people persist with the possible cold-blooded nature of dinosaurs. So are you familiar with the weather of these time periods? And if so, how much warmer was it?
Ooh, that's a good question. So at least in terms of Alberta, which is where I've done a lot of my work because that's where I went to grad school and lived for a really long time. Mm-hmm. Alberta is not tropical today, but was probably similar in temperature and climate to things like Louisiana and Florida back at that time period. So we're not talking like outrageously hot, although I mean, for me, like, I basically, like, die every day when I'm in, like, Florida in the summertime. I am just not a hot adapted human by any means. But so Florida and Louisiana, they obviously get, like, really hot in the summertime, and they can have hurricanes and big tropical storms, and that's, you know, that is definitely, like, a warm climate. But they can also have days where you get frosts or even snow, depending on the weather. So, you know, these dinosaurs that are living in Alberta are living in a much, much warmer environment than Alberta today, but it's not like they would never have experienced cold weather. And then that becomes even more true the further north you go, like up into, say, Alaska, which again was much warmer than it is today, but would still probably have had snow. And I think I've read some papers that said there even would have been sort of like slushy sea ice up in the Arctic, even back then with the warmer temperatures. So yeah, so warmer climates, but still sort of like within the realm of what we can comprehend today, I would say.
Yeah. So the moral of the story is basically it wasn't hot enough to support some endothermic animals these sizes.
I think that dinosaurs are complicated. I think the evidence points towards them being endothermic, but they're sort of endothermic maybe just because they're so big, if that makes sense. So they retain heat just by being big. This is getting a little bit away from like what I actually study, just like to clarify here. But yeah, that's, you know, the work that we've done shows that dinosaurs grew really fast, which is something that we see in birds and mammals, which have high growth rates and high metabolisms. Mm-hmm. Everything points to them being able to live in cooler environments than, say, like turtles and crocodiles do today. And everything kind of points towards them being like high metabolism, high energy animals for the most part. But they weren't mammals. They weren't the same as mammals. They aren't, you know, like most of them aren't birds, except for the ones that are, obviously.
Right.
But there's a lot of them that aren't really that similar to birds, really. Like an ankylosaur is not really like a bird, right? So you have to be a little bit careful, like sort of extrapolating back from birds all the way to ankylosaurs, in my opinion, because that's pretty much as far away as you can get
right.
still be a dinosaur. So I think that's the thing that is just important to like remind ourselves is that they might have evolved sort of their own approaches that we don't see in birds or mammals. They, you know, their own solutions to some of these problems in the environments that they lived in.
I've always considered them more likely to be endothermic than ectothermic simply because it's not that much hotter. They're like, you're going to have a metabolism that's like tearing through the food at the growth rates that we're seeing in these things. So there's not a whole huge dearth of evidence supporting ectothermic. And I don't know why that is still sort of persisting in this day and age.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I mean, even the split between like ectothermic and endothermic is not really like as it's not like the hard division that we get taught like necessarily. And there's lots of examples of like ectothermic animals that are actually endothermic. So there's examples of fish that are endothermic. So things like tuna are like endothermic.
Right.
Because they have high metabolisms and that's just like how they evolved, right? So there's lots of like exceptions to the rules and things that break the rules. So it's not very often that things kind of slot neatly into like one category or the other.
Yeah, it's kind of like physics because after a certain scale, when you get down super small, things don't act normal anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's, yeah, I mean, just being such large mammals in hot, or sorry, such large animals in hot environments probably meant they were like warm-blooded just almost by default.
Right.
Because the bigger you get, the more you retain heat. And we don't have any really big reptiles today. Like, I mean, big crocodiles are nowhere close to like big dinosaurs. And I think that there's arguments for like things like sea turtles actually being endothermic, even though they're turtles, which are ectothermic, right? Uh-huh. So that's the thing. It's like, it's all really complicated and it's hard to like work out exactly what like dinosaur metabolism would have been, but that doesn't mean people shouldn't try, but I think it's complicated. So
yeah, if I've learned nothing else from interviewing paleontologists is everything that you think you know as a kid is almost completely wrong.
But that's kind of good, right? Because that means that things aren't stagnating. It means that there's still like questions to ask and things to figure out. So I'm always happy. Like I'm glad when we see like discussions and debates about things like, you know, are they hot or cold blooded? And it feels like, okay, like maybe we've got this figured out, but we're still working out a lot of the details on a lot of these things. So I think it's not a bad thing necessarily.
I think it's great because as long as it's moving the field forward, I'm totally cool with it. I feel like on every dinosaur, you fall into one of two camps. And especially for Tyrannosaur, I fall into the more scaly camp, but I don't like to undercut the people with the feathered theories simply because there's so much we don't know. And I can't stake even my limited reputation on any of my inklings or leanings as just an observer.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the great thing is to just, like, I think a good approach for all of us really is to just think about what the evidence in front of us says at any given time, right? So, like, scaly Tyrannosaurus, feathery Tyrannosaurus, those are both great hypotheses that you test with more data, right? And the data is the fossils. And so the data right now, from what we have, tells us that it's probably mostly scaly for Tyrannosaurus. But the great thing is that if we found a fossil with feathers, we'd be like, okay, I guess, like, there's some feathers. There you go. So that's the great thing about it.
Yeah, that's one of the beautiful things about paleontology is a whole lot can change with one simple finding.
Yeah, it's true. And then other times you'll never get a satisfactory answer.
Right.
So there's, like, you know, there's the things that are really hard to know. And then there's the things that can change with just one fossil. So it's a pretty, like, I think it's an exciting field to be in for that reason.
Yeah.
Because who knows what tomorrow will bring? You just don't know sometimes.
It is a completely enthralling time to be alive and into dinosaurs. And speaking of such, has there been anything that you've found that really bucked your expectations? Have you found anything you're like, whoa, that's something that I had not even considered, or even mildly outside the box concerning ankylosaurs?
I haven't really had a moment like that yet. I would love nothing more than to have a moment like that. I guess maybe the closest thing is this fish-eating Liaoningosaurus, the little ankylosaur from China. If we find some more specimens that really support that particular hypothesis, that would be really weird, because that would be like a herbivore moving to being a fish eater in a really specialized way. So that would be really weird, but I remain slightly skeptical about it. So that's one of those ones where I think we got to have some more data to feel really good about that. A lot of the work that I do tends not to be so reliant on sort of like one fossil changing like the whole paradigm. I mean, maybe I'll find, I guess the thing is you don't know when you're going to find those things.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the work I've done right now has been kind of like sort of methodical testing of ideas and seeing how that aligns with like what we thought before and how can we approach some of these questions. I do a lot of questions about sort of like how things have changed through time and behaviors and some of these things that are a little bit harder to test. And so really what I'm doing when I'm testing the things that are a little bit more of a reach away from the fossils is I'm sort of removing options. So that's sort of what I consider myself to be doing, is like, if you whittle away the things that aren't possible, you get left with the things that are possible. And so that's kind of how I approach studying ankylosaur tail club swinging or tail club evolution or that sort of thing. Is you kind of like remove options and then see what you're left with.
Right. Yeah. Cause I feel like a lot of people, and even looking, like, if you do a quick search on Google right now for Liaoningosaurus, 90% of the pictures are of them looking like snapping turtles eating fish.
Yeah, so I love that illustration. I mean, I think it's super cool, and it's a really interesting idea for sure. Yeah, we just got to find some more fossils.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see how quickly an idea can spread, even though it hasn't necessarily been tested to its limits.
Right, right. Yeah.
So since you brought up tails a little while back there, we have erstwhile neglected it. Let's dive into that tail, man, because that's what people, 9 times out of 10, you say ankylosaur, they say, yeah, with the big club tail. So when are we seeing that first appear?
So actually, this is one of the projects that I really had a lot of fun with while I was doing my PhD, and I published back in 2015. And that was trying to see sort of the steps involved in evolving a tail club. So a tail club is really two parts, if you'll sort of bear with me for a moment here. So
sure.
Ankylosaurs have these really weird tails, right? The front part of the tail that connects to their big wide hips is flexible, and they look kind of like regular dinosaur tailbones, like you might see in other dinosaurs. It's kind of like a round disc and little prongs coming off of it, and that can like rotate around the ones around it.
Mm-hmm.
In the back part of the tail, usually like the back third to about the back half of the tail, everything changes and the vertebrae get really long and all those little processes that stick out the side suddenly like lock together and make this series of V shapes if you're looking at it from the top, and everything gets really, really rigid. And so this weird change to the vertebrae, we end up calling this structure the handle of the tail club. So the tail isn't sort of flexible all the way to the tip. It's stiff, sort of like the handle of a sledgehammer or an axe. And so it's easy to remember a handle for that reason.
Right.
And then the ankylosaurs have, you know, these osteoderms, we now know at least with Zool and the Mongolian ones, the osteoderms go all the way down the tail, which makes sense. They're mostly big spikes or smaller spikes as you go down towards the tip of the tail. But then the tip is enveloped in this huge blob of osteoderms. So there's two big ones on either side and then a bunch of small ones kind of finish off the tip. So the tip of the tail is like completely enclosed in these massive, huge, spongy osteoderms. And this has a great technical name that I did not come up with, but it is called the knob. And right. I just thank God, like every day, that the other part wasn't called the shaft, because I have to get up at conferences all the time and talk about knobs like over and over again. And it's just a disaster, like every time. There's no way for it not to sound horrible. And everybody sits and laughs at me in the front row. And that's fine. We all have fun. So a tail club is two things. It's the handle and the knob. It's not just the blob of bone at the end of the tail, because that stiff part of the tail is important for creating the force as they're swinging it and absorbing the impact stress and supporting the weight of the knob at the tip of the tail. Mm-hmm. So the question to me was, how did we get this structure? Did the knob come first? Did the handle come first, or did both of them show up at about the same time in the evolutionary history of ankylosaurs? And what I was able to find by going, just sort of keeping my eye open as I looked at different specimens and collected information during my PhD and revised their evolutionary relationships, is that it seems like stiffening of the tail happened a long time before enlarging those osteoderms at the tip of the tail and changing them into that kind of like big, massive shape. Mm-hmm. So it seems like they all start out with kind of flexible tails in the Jurassic and early Cretaceous. One of the earliest ones that might have a stiff tail is also Leonangosaurus, but we only know it from a couple of very, very small specimens. But it seems to be starting to do some of the things that stiffen the tip of the tail. And then there's a couple of ankylosaurs sort of in the mid-Cretaceous that seem to have a full handle, but without those osteoderms enveloping the tip of the tail, forming the knob. So it seems like they sort of go through this phase where they stiffen the tail, and they probably still had osteoderms like running down the tail. So it wasn't like they were just like naked.
Right.
But they aren't sort of forming that knob, that really distinctive, like enlarged chunk at the end.
So when they're stiffening the tail without the knob, is it used in the same way as if it were? Like, is it still used to whip around like a defense mechanism?
So I think it's really hard to answer that question. But the way that I like to think about it is that an axe, like if someone's running after you with an axe, that's like pretty scary, right? Like
right.
You'd be like, oh no, an axe guy, yeah. Like, run away.
Right.
So that would be like really bad, right? But if someone is running after you with a baseball bat, that is also pretty bad, even if it is not quite as bad as someone running after you with an axe. And I shouldn't really joke about this, but like, so I don't really want either of those things to happen, even if one of them is like objectively worse.
Granted.
So I think that might be one way of thinking about these tails. And this is something that I haven't even studied yet. Like this, it's, we only published this in like 2015. So a lot of these ideas are still really new, and we need other people to like test them and see if they agree with them too, and see if it holds up over time. But it's possible that having a stiff tail was still a pretty good weapon, especially if they've got like spiky osteoderms running down the side of the tail. That might have just been a pretty good weapon, like for supporting the spikes on either side of the tail. And then it was like later that they were like, oh wait a minute, like having a big like heavy thing at the end of the tail is even better. Yeah, so we don't really know, and I don't really know like how effective it is to have like a stiff tail with no tail club knob versus like a flexible tail. So these are all things that we could test and have fun sort of figuring out.
Right. And you know, speaking of the armaments of the ankylosaur here, it's interesting, and I'm sure someone must be thinking about this other than myself, but it's odd how the dinosaurs, as they evolved, they got either bigger or more armaments, or whatever the case may be. None of them really went and got a lot smarter.
Well, maybe they did. we just don't know.
Possibly. I'm more likening it to, and I realize humans are this sort of lightning in a bottle when it comes to intelligence and stuff like that. But when you've got all these giant monsters running around, it seems like the only option was either to get big or to get dangerous.
Yeah, I think that, so there's a couple different strategies that sort of trade-offs that we can look at in like modern animals. And if you're an animal that like can fit entirely inside the mouth of a predator, so we so say like, you know, a small lizard or whatever, you've got a couple of options. You can get really fast and run away from predators. You can get really good at hiding, so like camouflaged. Right. You can become really unpalatable, so maybe you become like toxic in some way, or you just become really hard to eat with all kinds of spikes where it's like maybe you curl up. Like, have you ever seen the Ouroboros lizard? It's a chordylid lizard. And it's really, really spiky, and when it feels threatened, it like curls up and like bites its own tail and becomes really hard to eat. So it basically like can't be swallowed by the predator that it would be swallowed by normally. So there's all these like different trade-offs, but you can't necessarily do two of those things at the same time. So it's really hard to be really armored and really fast. You basically, evolution can only really like go in one direction for the most part on those things, because as you get more armored, you get heavier and you can't run as fast, for example.
Yeah, it does seem like that most, if you look at any clade of dinosaurs, you say, okay, they went this way, they went this way, they went this way. You never see in any animal, really, a sort of like, oh, they got big and they got smart, or they got fast and they got armored, or they got big and they got fast. It's always, you just pick one and you go with it for the next umpteen million years.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, maybe the things that, like, you know, when you think about the animals that are, like, pretty smart today, like, you know, there's people, like, that research, like, how intelligence evolved, so I'm probably not the right person to talk about this, but but a lot of them, if I'm thinking about, like, familiar animals, like things like raccoons or monkeys or parrots, like things that let's leave out whales for right now, but like things that live like on land, a lot of those are relatively small animals, right? And we know that we don't know a lot about small dinosaurs, really, especially in North America, because the way that dinosaurs get preserved in North America favors big things and does not favor small things. Right. So it's possible that we just haven't really found animal like dinosaurs that kind of fall into that like raccoon niche when it comes down to it, like the sort of generalists that are smart and scavenging and sort of using their wiles to like carve out a niche for themselves. So yeah, I wouldn't say, yeah, I mean, it's just really hard to know because there's still so much information we just don't have.
Yeah, and even for a paleontologist, I imagine it's difficult to grapple with that complete ecosystem, because even if, like, because, you know, when you pick a species of dinosaur, you imagine it in your mind out in this field by itself. But it, realistically, it would be surrounded by insects and small mammals and weird fish and reptiles and all these other little things that, you know, would really help fill in the ecology, but since they're so small and American preservation does not favor them, it's easy to get lost in like, oh, this was a land of giants and nothing else.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it certainly was a land of giants, like, no question. But there's a lot of small things that don't get illustrated or don't get talked about as much. We do have a pretty good record using like microvertebrate sites. So when we go and we find lots of like teeth, or we like wash, like we take like lots of sediment and like wash it through sieves and collect up like the teeth and the things that remain, that gives us a pretty good picture of like the lizards and the small mammals and the like snakes and fish and rays and sharks and all the things that would have lived in those environments. But things that don't leave small bones or teeth, like some of that can still be really like tricky to figure out. And we're still finding like new dinosaurs, even in really well prospected places like Dinosaur Provincial Park in Alberta. So yeah, so I mean, that's why we go out every year and just keep looking for things.
Yeah, it's so... And, you know, I guess Mongolia has this, or, you know, Asia seems to have gotten the preferable treatment for preserving small specimens like Archaeopteryx with that fine sandstone that they've got. So I wonder, you said before, it's hard to find an adult ankylosaur in Mongolia. It's interesting to see, you know, the ecology of one because of the geological events that was happening that did not happen in another.
Yeah, this is just like one of the fun but also frustrating puzzles of paleontology, is sort of grappling with missing data. It's a thing that I think some of my colleagues who work on like extant evolutionary biology don't have to worry about in quite the same way always. But that's okay. We just have a different perspective. We just are working with different kinds of data, and you just have to keep all of those things in mind.
Right. So Now, I sort of broached this with Matthew and Andy, and I got the turtle nachos theory out of Matt, and we sort of touched upon what maybe dinosaurs smelled like with Andy. So do you have any wild theories that you would like to, maybe you don't have all the evidence for, maybe you don't have maybe any evidence for, but does your gut tell you something that would be wild or, you know, people would look at you in a funny way?
About dinosaur smells or just anything?
Dinosaurs in general. I'm not going to limit you to smells.
Because I was going to say, I have a pretty good idea of what ankylosaurs smell like when you are a giant fat plant eater.
Right.
There's probably only one way you can smell.
Yeah, probably not great.
And it probably smells a lot like methane. But who knows? I mean, maybe not. But I have my suspicions.
Right.
I don't know. Crazy ideas. I don't like crazy ideas.
Yeah, they're not for everybody.
No, I'm just teasing. I like because I don't know. I don't know if there are a lot of like really crazy ideas. I think there are ideas that are really hard to test, if that makes sense. So I think there are like the ideas that are not necessarily wrong, but are really hard to test scientifically. Like, how can we reject or like support those hypotheses? But it doesn't necessarily mean they're wrong. It just means that maybe we can never really know. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Maybe my favorite idea is whether or not there are feathery ankylosaurs. So we talk a lot about feathered dinosaurs and fluffy dinosaurs and how far back do feathers and fluff go and where do they first originate on the dinosaur tree and does fluff show up a couple of different times and only one fluff group goes into feathers. And so one of the groups that has never really had any fluff associated with it are the ankylosaurs, right? And a lot of people are like, oh, well, ankylosaurs could never have like fluff or hair or whatever because they have osteoderms. And then I just am like, you should Google the screaming hairy armadillo. It is both of those things. And it is screaming and hairy, like extremely hairy, like distressingly hairy. So osteoderms, like having an osteoderm doesn't necessarily mean you can't have hair because like armadillos exist and have hair and osteoderms. And certainly like the places where we find ankylosaurs are not really conducive to having like filament preservation necessarily. So a lot of them are found in the sandstones where we're starting to get feather fossils like from Alberta, but they're really hard to spot. Like they're not obvious. And I think it would be easy to prepare through them. So everything that we have right now in terms of the data suggests that ankylosaurs are scaly. So we've got that beautiful Tyrrell specimen. We have Zool. We've got classic specimens like the holotype of Skull. All of those are scaly and none of them have anything that suggests they could have fluff or filaments or whatever you want to call like non-feathery dino fuzz. But I think it would be really cool if one day we found an ankylosaur, like maybe coming out of China, that had like fluff on it. Maybe a small one with osteoderms and fluff, and it's like a screaming hairy ankylosaurus. Like,
that would be interesting.
I think that would be really cool, and I think it would tell us a lot about how fluff like shows up in different dinosaurs, and whether or not it just evolved once at the base of the tree, or what it's doing in different groups. So, that's probably about as far fetched as I get. I guess like I would like a hairy ankylosaur, basically like a gross hairy like warthog ankylosaur, not like a cute one. Like none of this, like there's no cute with ankylosaurs; they're just gross all the time. So it needs to be like a really gross kind of hairy. Like that's what I would like.
That's a consummation devoutly to be wished, I'm sure. I can't, that is pretty wild. I can't imagine a hairy, because I did do a quick search and look up the screaming hairy armadillo,
it's what it's called. It's just what it's called.
Can't recommend that enough, listeners. So do check that out and imagine that on an ankylosaur.
Make sure you have the sound on. so again, like we don't have any evidence for that. I don't think it's impossible, but I think it's really unlikely. But I would be like over the moon if we found one like that, because it would just be so weird.
And that's the thing, in dinosaurs, the weirder the better. So if, like, I don't think anyone would turn their nose up at a hairy ankylosaur.
Oh no, I certainly hope not.
Oh boy. Now speaking of the titular Zool, Let's jump into that, baby. So now I've been following your work on Twitter since news broke. So I'm going to sort of ask leading questions for the benefit of the audience.
No worries.
So where was Zuul found?
Zuul is from Montana, from a town called Haver, which is pretty close to the border with Canada, which is great because my sort of postdoc supervisor and the curator of paleontology or vertebrate paleontology at the Royal Ontario Museum, where I work, is he works just on the other side of the border in southern Alberta. And the rocks that this particular ankylosaur came from, even though he is not from Canada, correspond like pretty much exactly to the rocks on the other side of the border. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like a nice extension of that field area and that time period that they're working on, trying to fill in some of the gaps in our knowledge of North American dinosaurs. And they didn't have an ankylosaur yet from the Canadian side. So it was an obvious choice for the ROM to acquire this particular specimen.
Yeah. Okay. So now, you know, Zuul, it breaks big. There you are, front and center, taking pictures with this amazing this amazing find, because we've got soft tissue, we've got an almost complete skull.
Oh, yeah.
So that skull, most of the pictures you see are from the left side. And so I saw on the right side there was a little bit of damage.
Just a little bit. It's more just that it's a little bit squished, really. So it doesn't photograph as well. It's basically just missing the tip of that horn that's under the cheek. But everything else is there, just a little bit smushed flat.
So what have you been able, now most of it is still in the media of its trapping. So how far are we at its preservation and preparation?
Yeah, so for this first paper, we wanted to get it out there quickly, and we had all of the parts that we felt were really most diagnostic. So the skull is obviously really diagnostic, and the tail is actually really helpful, too, when we can compare it with other specimens, like in terms of the tail club knob shape, the length of the tail, and the osteoderms, and like the shapes and arrangement of them. So that was really helpful and useful for us to be able to like identify it. So the skull is completely prepared out. The tail is kind of like half prepared because we're leaving it sort of in situ and we're trying to leave sediment on it so that we can do various types of chemical and sort of biomolecular tests on the soft tissue. So we don't want to like disturb that and contaminate it yet, which is why it might look a little unfinished in some places.
Right.
And so then we also are really lucky to have the belly of Zuul. But the belly is still, it's, we just went out to visit it again, like 2 weeks ago. And the thing weighs like 15,000 kilograms.
Whoa. So
it's really dumb. It's so huge. It's basically like an entire quarry, like sitting in this like facility. It's actually so big that we can't fit it in the ROM yet. It's too heavy for the floor and too wide for the doors. So
that is wild.
So it is out just a couple hours away at the amazing place called Research Casting International, which does a lot of preparation and fabrication for museums. And so they do a lot of work making exhibits and preparing fossils and remounting specimens and all of that great stuff. So they're sort of storing it for us right now. And one of my colleagues that I did grad school with, Robin Sissons, she was out there preparing it. She's away for the summer now doing field work, but we're hoping to have her back in the fall working away on it and hopefully having a couple more people. But it's a really big job to prepare something of that size. It won't be 15,000 kilograms by the end, hopefully, but it's just a really huge rock right now. It's got the hips. Right now we can see the hips. We can sort of see the two ilia, so the big blade hip bones that are like most of the hips in ankylosaurs.
Right.
We can see the backbone running up to probably about where the shoulders would have been. We can see ribs. We can see some of the big spiky osteoderms in there. And we also found some of the neck armor just a little bit away from where we would have expected it. So the head and the neck had obviously sort of pulled off of the rest of the body a little bit. And then it seems like once you hit about the shoulders, everything's articulated going back to the tip of the tail.
Wow. So since we've got, I got a couple of questions. Since we've got soft tissue on the tail of this thing, I imagine that obviously changes the way it will be prepared. Because if you just got bones, you want to get that rock out of there and you can get it mounted or whatever. So with the soft tissue of the tail, how does that go? Is it going to stay in the rock mostly?
Yeah, at least for the time being, we will leave a lot of rock in place as we prepare parts of it. So there's two different sort of, so I guess when I'm talking about soft tissue, there's kind of like two different ways the soft tissue is preserved in the specimen. There is impressions of the skin, which are not like the original skin itself, but it's like the impressions in the rock surrounding it, or like in the rock that like represents the body. Mm. And so that's just rock and doesn't contain like original molecules or anything. And that's not common, but it is something that we see in like duck-billed dinosaur mummies and like other dinosaurs where you get skin impressions. Most of the time when you talk about skin, it's like skin impressions.
Right.
So we have that, but we also have very unusual preservation where it's not a skin impression, but it's actually like a black or dark gray organic stuff. And so it covers the big spikes on the tail. It forms like scale patterns on the top of the tail. And so this we are pretty sure is the actual like preserved skin. Wow. And not just like an impression of it. And so those are like the sheaths, the sort of fingernail like sheaths that cover the osteoderms, as well as the actual just scale itself, like the skin in between the osteoderms as well. So that's really interesting. And that's the stuff that we're really hoping will provide us more information on like the ancient proteins that were in Zool's skin. So some of my colleagues who've worked down in North Carolina, they do some amazing work, Mary Schweitzer and Allison Moyer, where they isolate things like keratin from ancient fossils. So keratin is the stuff in your fingernails and your hair. There's also been work done on collagen in dinosaur fossils. So that's come out of like blood vessels, but that's a really common like soft tissue all throughout our body.
Right.
And also doing things like isolating. So like say the iron from the blood, like heme iron, versus just like iron from groundwater. So we're hoping to be able to test for some of these ancient molecules, but that definitely makes preparing the fossil a challenge because on the one hand, it's really different from things that we've seen before, and our preparators at the ROM, Shino and Ian Morrison, who are just amazing preparators. They're so thorough and careful, and they worked so hard to get Zool ready for us really quickly. they like really like busted their derrieres to get that guy ready. They've just been doing amazing work, but it is really slow and tedious, and we want to do a good job on this fossil, right? So it's hard to spot the skin impressions, and we can't use glue on the stuff that looks like original skin because the components of like the glues and the consolidants we use will mess up the biomolecular analyses. So right. We have to be really careful. We can't just like drench it in glue. So it's definitely like a slow, methodical process for preparing this particular fossil.
Yeah, man. So what is your rough estimate? Like when all is said and done and it's prepared as much as you are willing to prepare it, how long time frame wise are we looking?
It depends a lot on how many people work on it. It's probably going to be at least a year or two, you know, a year if we had a bunch of people working on it full time every day. It's so huge we can fit like multiple people around it and they wouldn't even right. like see each other basically. So obviously it gets a little harder as you get like closer in and you remove more and more. So it's really hard to say right now because it sort of depends on how many people can be hired to work on it basically.
Yeah, the fossil preparation takes a lot more time than I think people give credit.
It really does. It takes a long time. You want to be careful. Like, you don't want to rush things. It's really easy for fossils to break, even if you know what you're doing. So you just have, mm-hmm. like, the way around that is to go really slowly. And then when you encounter things that aren't bone, like the skin impressions or the actual fossilized skin, it just gets even more complicated. So it's definitely a highly skilled job, and I definitely, like, really value the people who work with us to prepare the fossils that we end up studying, because yeah. it's a really hard job, and I can't do all of it myself, for sure, so.
No kidding. With 30,000 pounds of rock, I mean, you're going to need some help.
Yeah, for sure.
So in that, in Zool's tail, what are we seeing here? Like, if someone pulls up a picture of Zool's tail, are the fibrous tissue that we're seeing along it, the tendons, what exactly are we looking at?
Oh yeah, okay, so if you were looking at a picture of Zool, you'd see some stuff that's probably relatively easy to understand, like the big blob of bone at the tip. You can see like the knob of bone. You can see that sort of stiff part of the tail all sort of exposed, and you'll see big triangles along the sides of it, and those are the osteoderm spikes that are not the tail club knob. but made of the same material. Mm-hmm. You might also notice some sort of like spaghetti noodle looking stuff along the stiff part of the tail. And those are called ossified tendons. And those are something that are found in other dinosaurs. It's basically tendons that have become bone.
Right.
But they're really cool in ankylosaurs because they run in these like really long strips down the side of the tail club. And I don't know exactly how those would have helped with tail club swinging. It's possible that they might have stored elastic energy, or they might have helped sort of support the tail without having to use a lot of muscular energy to keep it off of the ground. But I haven't really done a lot of work into exactly how those contribute to just the tail biomechanics in general. But they're really cool and really interesting. And then as you go sort of towards the other side of the tail, that's where it gets a little harder to understand if you like are just looking at a picture of it and you haven't seen it in person. There's still a lot of rock on it, and that's because we are trying to preserve soft tissues in there.
So what type of rock was it preserved in? It's a white... Does it look like granite?
Yeah, it's thankfully not granite. So granite can't really preserve fossils because it forms like deep inside the earth, like crystallizing from magma. So this is actually found in a sandstone that represents an ancient stream channel.
Okay. Yeah, because it's... granite was probably the dumbest thing I've ever said. Because it has to be sedimentary.
But that's okay. But lots of people don't know. I mean, like, that's fine. Like, there's plenty of people who do not know, like, the different kinds of rocks. So it's totally understandable for someone to come and be like, is this granite? And I'll be like, definitely not. But I understand where that question is coming from. So sometimes you can get fossils in lightly metamorphic rock. So things like slate or things that are, you know, sedimentary rocks that have just been a little bit metamorphosed. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you can get fossils in like volcanic sediments, but they're still kind of like they're in that gray zone of like sedimentary rocks, right? It's where it's like things that volcanoes have spewed out. So it's kind of a sedimentary rock, but it's also a volcanic rock. Mm-hmm. We call them like volcaniclastic rocks. So things that are in like ash, sort of ancient ash layers or things like that. But yeah, pretty much dinosaurs, as far as I know, there are no sort of like really weird dinosaur sort of host rocks that I know of.
Yeah, and that makes sense. Because, I mean, whether it's coming via water or via air, it's got to get covered up by something.
Yeah, exactly. So the most common places to find dinosaurs are in, like, stream channels, the sort of overbanks of streams when it's flooded, dunes, lakes. I'm trying to think what else. Those are probably, like, the main obvious ones.
Mm-hmm. Now, Zool, obviously named after the Ghostbusters character, and I don't imagine there's a huge long story of how you came upon that name, seeing the similarities.
It's true. So it's really funny. So like for a couple of years, I had been like, you know what would be a good name for an ankylosaur? I think Zool would be a good name for an ankylosaur.
So you had this preloaded.
So, well, a little bit, but it needed to be one that really looked like it, right? So, it couldn't just be like any like random fossil. I also have this like, I guess like game that I am doing where I am naming every ankylosaur I find at starting with Zed, because I really want someone to put an ankylosaur on the Zed page of the like dinosaur alphabet books. Okay. So I feel like if I just keep doing that, then eventually someone will have to do it.
Well, with Zool, I mean, how can you not?
Right. So now there's three, you guys. There's three Zed ankylosaurs. There's like so many choices. They're all really nice fossils. One of them can probably go in the alphabet books, whoever is doing the next alphabet book. Anyway.
We just have to drum up more publicity for ankylosaurs. I think that's the only problem.
I figure someone will either get irritated with me and just put one in to like make me stop, or they'll just be like, oh, what a great idea. And then they'll do it also. So I figure it's like pretty much a win-win situation. Anyway, so I really wanted to have an ankylosaur with a name that started with Zed, and I thought Zool was really funny. And so at first we weren't really sure if Zool was a new species. It's very similar in a lot of ways to some of its really close relatives, like you would expect. So we didn't sort of go into this like, this is a new species. We went into this like, what species can we refer this to? And when we finally were like, it doesn't fit in any of the existing ones, we'll have to name it. Oh no. I remember looking at David and I was like, well, you know what we should do, David, is we should just call it Zool, because look at it. And he was like, oh my God, now we have to do that. And that was pretty much it. I was like, really? Are you sure? Because like, that's also kind of a ridiculous name. And he was like, no, it's so perfect and funny. We have to do it now. So that was like basically the entirety of the discussion. And then it was just Zool from there out. Like it couldn't be anything else, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to find a paleontologist who also isn't steeped in, like, nerd pop culture. They go hand in hand.
It's true.
And jumping, I would rather imagine a children's book illustrator being like, fine, I'll do it, instead of like, oh, this is cool. I'd rather have him do it out of irritation than acceptance.
Stop, Victoria.
Like, hey, you should have done this a while ago, P.S. So... So if you do the search for Zool, you will obviously see the pictures of Dan Aykroyd coming and blessing it with his holy aura. Yes. So did you get to meet him?
I did. Yeah, I toured him around the specimen and introduced him to everything in the lab. And so this is the thing. So everyone's like, oh my God, how'd you get Dan Aykroyd? So Dan Aykroyd is actually like a huge supporter of Canadian paleontology. Mm-hmm. He's done a lot of support. Him and his family, his wife Donna, they've been really supportive of work happening out in Alberta. So there's a new museum that got built in Grand Prairie, and they did a lot of work supporting that project. And so when we knew this paper was accepted, we were like, oh, we should, you know, David was like, we should email Dan and just like tell him we're doing this. So it's not like a total, like, probably we should do that, right? Like, that's a thing we should do. And I was like, yeah, I think so. And they were just so excited that we were doing it. And, you know, we weren't sort of doing it for publicity. I literally did it because I thought it was funny. But then it was so wonderful that he wanted to come out and see it. He's like, well, I have to come out and see it right away. And so it was only about 2 weeks after that they were coming by the Royal Ontario Museum to check out the blue whale exhibit that we have on and see some of the other things that are going on. And so they came up to take a look at Zool. And yeah, it was great. I mean, he's just so enthusiastic, big supporter of like scientific research and paleontology in Canada. So it was really nice that he was willing to do the little video intro for us, because that definitely added a little extra special, I think, little special thing about our fossil, that, you know, maybe got people to look at a paleontology story that wouldn't look at it otherwise.
Yeah, because I always think that these are like world-shaking news. When these things are coming down my Twitter feed or I'm reading the papers on them, I'm like, oh man, everybody is going to be blown away. But you have to stop and think, like, not everybody is super into dinosaurs, as crazy as that sounds.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing, is like, we thought the name was funny, but it also worked out really well because it connected with people who wouldn't necessarily go and like look up science stories, right? Like this, because of like the connection with Ghostbusters, it got into a lot of the like movie sites. So it was on like the AV Club, and it was in like a bunch of like Ghostbuster fan sites and all these things. So it was kind of cool. I mean, it was slightly unintentional, but I am always trying to think about new ways to like reach different groups of people who might not be looking for science stories to begin with. And obviously like nerd culture is like relatively favorable towards science stories, I would say, but it's not necessarily like people would be going and looking for this kind of news story. So I think it worked out really well. Like, we were really happy that it got so much attention, and yeah, it was just really fun. And it was really crazy for like 3 days, and then it was over, which is always the best part of those things.
I can't, like, speaking like about the Venn diagram of things that paleontology can overlap with, I think that modern nerd culture is the biggest overlap. And that's the thing with, you know, Jurassic Park and Jurassic World becoming, you know, a big sensation again. It's never been a better time to sort of catch the mainstream media's eye and hopefully start dispelling some of the myths put in there by the movies.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really good. Like, so obviously, like, nerd culture does a lot of, and like geek culture has like an affinity for like sci-fi and things like that. But I'm not sure how much like actual like science news necessarily reaches all of those kind of like, all the like the geekosphere, the nerdosphere, I don't know what you want to call it. So there's a lot of sort of like science adjacent things, but I'm not always sure how much like just here's some science that a scientist did like gets out there. So I think it's good. I mean, it's nice to have like something real that kind of infiltrates into the sort of pop culture sphere once in a while.
Yeah, it's difficult just being like an outside observer, because when I'm looking up all these papers, like I read one on the megalosaur jaw they did that I mentioned earlier in a previous interview, and all these other stories that like Tom Holtz will post, and these very dry scientific papers, which are interesting unless you're super into it. All of the sort of the minutiae and the details sort of are lost on people as a whole. So I, with this with Zool coming in and blowing up as it did with and tying in with a huge pop culture touchstone, I imagine that made it more accessible, because I don't imagine a lot of people are going to be like, oh, here's a new study on, you know, the shin bone of a hadrosaur that had some weird marking on it. So
yeah.
I only wish that could happen more often.
It's true. I mean, I think it's okay, though, that not every paper, you know, not every paper is going to connect with like a huge audience like that.
Right.
And that's okay, because a lot of the way science works is kind of like all of us are working together and we're all contributing our own little pieces to the puzzle. And then every now and then one of us sort of like collects a bunch of those ideas together and synthesizes them. And then you've got like a really great story you can share with the public. Right. So, I mean, I've certainly like written lots of papers about ankylosaurs that like do not get media attention on their own. But then I can sit and chat with someone for like an hour and a half about cool stuff about ankylosaurs, and it all gets like synthesized together. And I think that's okay, you know, like, so not every story is necessarily like a giant public interest story, but it's really great when you have like a really charismatic fossil like Zool that you can share with everyone and then pull in some of those other like smaller stories in along with it.
Yeah, and I can also see it being sort of a double-edged sword, simply because if the information is new and it's all just sort of happening in a whirlwind, it's easy to later go back and find, oh, well, that this actually meant this. And I can see the reservations that a lot of people have with sort of sharing the information they have out of simple fear that maybe something will come along almost immediately at the way these things are spreading, or the field of paleontology is moving, that you could easily be caught up in like, oh, well, that was true last week, but now not so much.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think it's kind of maybe not unique to science. It's definitely like a characteristic of science that you have to constantly put yourself out there to be judged in a sense. And it's not really like you're being judged, it's your work that's being judged, but it's hard to separate your work from yourself sometimes, right? Because it's like, it's very all consuming a lot of the time,
right?
And you pour a lot of your heart and soul into things. And so you want things to like hold up and stand the test of time. And not everything does always, and that's okay. It's definitely, you have to have a little bit of a thick skin. So I aspire to resemble my study organism more and more every year. I need the thick hide of the ankylosaur so you can go out there and talk about things and be okay with being wrong sometimes.
Yeah, and that's part of you know, being a scientist, is like you're going off of the information that you have, and that's as good as we can hope to get, because you can't just, you know, you can't fabricate something that doesn't exist. And so I think even though it is probably tough to have a hypothesis or a theory overturned by new evidence, and being wildly insecure myself, I can imagine that being devastating, but also somewhat exciting, simply because now you have more information to build off a better understanding of these creatures.
Yeah, you have to be a little bit zen about it sometimes, I guess, right? So it's like you got to put forward the best thing that you have, but someone might come along and have evidence that says no. And that's
right.
Just like, that just could happen, right? And so you just do the best you can with the evidence that you have today. And in some ways, you kind of hope that someone will have better evidence tomorrow. I mean, I would prefer if that tomorrow was like 50 years from now when I'm like 100, right? Or like, I guess I'm not 100 in 50 years, but like,
yeah.
There's the math at like 10:40 p.m. coming in. So yeah, anyway, so you know, you want to like have things that stand the test of time, but sometimes in paleontology, that time might be like tomorrow. So,
right.
And you just have to kind of accept that, I guess.
So what are you looking to get out of paleontology? What are you hoping to bring to the world? Because, you know, various people say, oh, you know, various ecological factors, or, you know, about global warming, or about the mechanics of the animal and how that could apply to technology of today. What exactly are you looking for? And P.S., I will completely accept the answer that they're cool and that's it.
So some of the sort of big picture questions I'm really interested in, especially right now, are questions about how armor evolves and how weapons evolve, not just in ankylosaurs, but in all animals. And I'm obviously coming at it from like looking at ankylosaurs, but these are features we see in lots of other things. So some of the projects I'm working on right now are like, why do tail weapons only evolve in a few groups of animals, and why don't more animals even use their tails as weapons at all. Head weapons are really common, but tail weapons are really rare. So that's some of the work I've been doing before I moved to Toronto, and hopefully will be published by the end of this year, or maybe like next year. So just looking at sort of like trade-offs with armor and weapons and all of that kind of fun stuff, and how tail weapons evolved convergently between glyptodonts and ankylosaurs and all of that good stuff. I'm also pretty interested in biogeography of dinosaurs and how things like climate and sea level and plate tectonics influenced how they moved in between North America and Asia back in the Cretaceous period. And so that's actually some of the work that I'm doing when I'm not working on Zool here as part of my postdoc at the ROM. And so while I'm certainly not going to solve global warming by studying right. that, I think it's important to look at like deep time, sort of have like a deep time perspective on climate change in the past and how it influenced ecosystems that weren't mammal dominated ecosystems. So like what happened when dinosaurs faced rising sea levels? Some of them went extinct. Why did some clades go extinct? How come some clades were able to migrate across the Bering land bridge, but others weren't? I think these are interesting questions to ask and just to understand, like, what are the patterns we see in the fossil record and what can we learn about that as we enter a period where we're probably going to see rising sea levels, we're going to see rising temperatures, all of that really fun stuff to look forward to 50 years from now. So those are some of the, like, the big picture questions, I guess, that I'd like to answer over the course of my career and my lifetime and sort of make some small contributions to, I guess.
Right. Yeah, that there's never anybody into it just because like, oh, you know, it's just something I sort of fell into. There's always these bigger picture questions, and especially in these dinosaurs that are visibly recognizable by anybody. There's not a lot of information behind them to really illustrate their behavior and like their migration patterns and how they reacted to certain things.
Yeah, I mean, I also think there's, on a more philosophical level, I think there's a lot to be said for having people out there just studying the world around us, even if there isn't a direct monetary benefit right away.
Oh, completely.
And so sometimes people will be like, oh, okay, yeah, but like, you know, you're not curing cancer and whatever. So like, how do you justify like raising money? And sometimes I just have to be like, look, like we live in a world where like Paris Hilton exists and NASCAR exists and all kinds of things that I have no interest in exist, but other people derive pleasure and benefit from. So maybe we can have a couple people who study armored dinosaurs. I'm picking things that are like very alien to me, but like, I don't even want to criticize that. I think sport is great. I think music is great. I think art is great. Culture is like, all of those things are great, but lots of those things are just not things I'm interested in. But right. I like that we live in a world where all of those things exist as like choices for people. And I wish that we could kind of look at science the same way sometimes too, that like just simply being able to have this knowledge like enriches us, like that we can do more than just like survive and like get by day to day and actually like learn things about everything around us. So I do think there are practical things paleontology can contribute, but I wish that we didn't always have to reduce science down to that in quite the same way.
Right, because essentially science should exist for the sake of itself, for a better understanding of, you know, X, Y, or Z. I imagine you get that a lot as people are like, well, why do you do this? What are you looking to gain? And it doesn't need to have a greater purpose other than the fuller understanding of the world around us. Because that, no matter how you know, unimportant that may seem to some people, like any information about Earth, us, animals, etc., is important no matter what, at least I think.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that's really obvious to me at times is that there's so many things we don't know, and there are so many questions that we don't even know to ask yet. Like, 10 years ago, I probably would not have asked, like, why don't more things have tail weapons? Because I just hadn't thought of that question yet. I needed to have a certain level of knowledge before I could even ask some of the questions I'm asking today. And so I think that science really operates that way too. Like, we don't know what we will want to know 100 years from now. The only way to sort of prepare ourselves for future problems and future questions is to have as broad a knowledge as possible today with the things that we can ask today. And so I think that's kind of where paleontology comes in. It's like, maybe paleontology doesn't like make money today, but like maybe 100 years from now, we're going to be like, damn, I'm really glad that like that person figured out how tail weapons evolved. Like, you know what I mean? Like, maybe right. That's a little crazy, but like, it's just really hard to know, right? I mean, you just don't know sometimes.
Yeah, it's impossible to say what science will produce. And people who are like, well, you know, they don't see, like, I don't personally see any merit in paleobotany because I think it is boring.
Oh, no.
But I see its importance, so I don't badmouth it because I understand you need to find out, you know, the ecology of some place, and you need paleobotany for such things. You need to know what was alive, how these plants evolved, because it gives us a greater understanding of our world. So you'll never hear me saying like, oh, why would anybody be a paleobotanist? Because I understand that they are needed and they are necessary and they are a big part of the paleontological world.
Right. I have to tell you, there are some really nice plant fossils in Zool's quarry.
I'm sure.
There's just
yeah.
like beautiful leaves all around it. So I don't know very much about them, but we will definitely have some people help us out with that and learn more about like, yeah, the whole environment that Zool lived in. So yeah, I mean, that's the thing is like everybody has their different interests and that's great because that means that no one person has to like become an expert in everything, which would be really right. hard to do. There's all these like all these questions to ask and all these different little niches for all of us to fill, which is great because it means there's lots of space for lots more people in paleontology.
Yeah, because a lot of people, I think, look at paleontology and even zoology, and this may be a dated reference, but, you know, Jack Hanna appears to know everything about every animal ever, right. which is completely unrealistic.
Right, right.
Like, and that's what I'm finding out with paleontology more and more is, like, you can't go up to a paleontologist and be like, what did this duck-bill dinosaur sound look like, blah, blah, blah. If they're a ceratopsian specialist, you know, they might not have a better answer than you.
Right, right.
So it's such a huge field, and it's interesting to see and meet all of the people in these different facets from sauropods, ceratopsians, tyrannosaurs, ankylosaurs, stegosaurs, whatever. Like you wouldn't ask a lion specialist about like a bullfrog.
Right.
There's just too much.
Yeah, it's true. It's it's great to have like. It's really valuable to have like a broad knowledge of lots of different topics as a paleontologist, but you definitely like, it's hard to be an expert in everything. I mean, there's just so much to know. Like, I don't know where you would fit everything in your brain.
Yeah. And the way and the speed at which it's coming out and it's being disseminated so quickly through social media, it would be impossible. So
oh, yeah,
there's no way. So here's a question that I ask everybody, and I gotta know because I feel like this is a very defining personality question. Are you a Cope or a Marsh fan?
I'm neither.
Oh, boy. Okay, so contemporary to them, are there any of the like pioneering paleontologists that you like over Cope or Marsh?
How about I can be an Anning?
Okay, yeah. Well, I usually ask the Cope Marsh thing because it's usually North American centric. But if you wanted to be part of Mary Anning's crew, you know, I have no problem with that.
Yeah, let's do that. That sounds good.
I gotta say, it's very great to see that more women are getting into science because it's been mostly and stereotypically a man's field. So the fact that you're in the position you're in, I think, is terrific because I think there should be more women paleontologists because even, you know, back when I got into paleontology and dinosaurs back in the 80s, you had the big names like Curie, Bakker, Horner, and people have heard me say these names 40 or 50 million times. But there aren't very many females getting into science, there weren't back in the day. And now that is seeing a big uptick in that, which is terrific. And so I think Mary Anning is a perfect perfect answer to that question.
Well, thank you. I thought it was pretty good, too.
and something I learned that I'm just going to regurgitate because I've got nothing important of my own devising, that nursery rhyme, she sells seashells down by the seashore, was based on Mary Anning.
Yes, I've heard that. I like that little factoid.
Yeah, and I've never been able to say that to another living person, so thank you for affording me that opportunity.
You are welcome. I think that paleontology is going through a big shift. I mean, it's such a global science, right? I mean, I have colleagues all over the world, which is just wonderful. I'd like to see more colleagues in more places, like especially more people working in places that don't really have paleontology programs, like really strong ones right now, and just building it up all over the world. And in terms of women, I mean, it makes me a little sad when we talk about this because I'm still not in a permanent position myself. I mean, I'm very happy with everything that's happening. It's just really, it's hard for anyone to get a faculty position in paleontology. But I will say that it's starting to get a little bit lonelier around here. There was lots of ladies around me during grad school, and it's just hard. It's still really hard for women to break into those permanent positions and just keep working their way up. It's hard for everybody, but that's the thing, is like when it's hard for everybody and you're in like a non-dominant group, it's just, yeah, that just like all of those things just compound on each other. So yeah, I mean, I know lots of really cool women doing lots of great paleontology, like not just dinosaurs, but all kinds of different things. And yeah, so it's great when we can give little shout outs and get people more recognition for all the people doing cool work out there as well. And I think this is something David and I have talked about too, is that I think we're not really in the same sort of like media personality age anymore. So I don't know if we'll ever have sort of like icons of paleontology like Bakker and Curry and Horner in the same way. Like, you know, those were like the guys like doing paleontology. Right. And now there's tons of us all doing different things, right? So maybe we don't need to have like the next Marsh and Coe. Maybe we don't need to have the next Bakker and Curry because we're going to have like 100 people all doing really cool work, all talking to different groups of people.
And as you say that, that makes a whole lot of sense, because back in the day, you had documentaries that were helmed by either like stars, going all the way back to Dinosaur, hosted by Christopher Reeves.
Right. Or I liked the Walter Cronkite one, personally. That was my favorite when I was growing up.
Yeah, everybody has the one that they first saw that they watched 400,000 times. And I must have seen Philip Curry in his maybe early 30s sitting on a rock explaining the centrosaur bone bed to me a zillion times. So I don't know. It's kind of a double-edged sword, because I feel like paleontology does need these luminaries to sort of draw in the crowd with their weird flamboyant personnel, especially Bakker, with their big flamboyant personalities. But as information becomes more and more easily available, I don't think we need like as many people on the ramparts blowing the trumpets of paleontology.
Yeah, it's kind of like when I really like Twitter, for example, because I get to follow people who I would never have heard about on TV, but I feel like I don't even need TV. Like I haven't even had TV in like 10 years. Like everything's shifting, right? Like so I think it's just different, right? Like there's the people who you might hear on a podcast, you might hear people by following them on Twitter and learning about their work directly from them without any editing by like a documentary or anything like that. Right. Maybe you come across someone's blog. And so you're getting so much more just kind of like direct from individual scientists these days. And that can be really inspiring. I mean, I read a lot of blogs by women scientists while I was doing grad school, and that definitely like shaped my approach to science communication and approaching academic research. And I learned a lot of things I probably wouldn't have learned otherwise. And I definitely learn a lot more through Twitter than I probably would if I just watched like cable news, for example. Mm-hmm. So all of these things have different reaches and different audiences, and no one thing is like better or worse. But I guess that's the thing, is everything's sort of fragmenting more now. So I just don't know if it'll be like, I don't know if, like, sometimes I've been asked like on documentaries, like, oh, who do you think will be the next Phil Curry? And I'll be like, me. And they're like, haha, but no, really. And then I'm like, hey, that's not fair. And then yeah. Like, why'd you ask me if you don't like that answer? But it's hard to even answer that question, because who do you pick, right? Like, I know like 30 people who would make awesome headliners on a show, right? Like, I right. mean, so yeah, it's just, it's, and all of them are good scientists. So, I mean, how do you even answer that question?
I think that's the thing. We're just moving to a very, because before we had a very narrow pool of personalities, but it was very deep, because you could spend all your time talking to Curry And you know, that he was on dozens of documentaries, so it seemed like his breadth of information was so far-reaching.
Oh, and I mean, it is. Like, Phil was my PhD supervisor, and I mean, Phil knows a lot about everything.
Oh, I'm sure.
Like, I mean,
yeah.
He, like, his reputation and his fame are well-earned, so it's certainly no, like, criticism of him when I'm talking about this. It's just, I just think everything is different now than it was. Like, it's just a different time, and there's just so many more people working in paleontology, and I mean, people like Phil and Bakker, like, paved the way for my generation to also mm-hmm. go out there and talk about dinosaurs, so yeah. So it's good. I think it's just the natural consequence of it, right? Like, we've reproduced, we've accelerated our population.
Paleontology has had an interesting evolution, if you will, because it started out, you know, with like, let's say, Cuvier and that ilk back in the old days, finding the very first. Then you have these fame-hungry monsters like Cope and Marsh,
right.
Essentially, like, blowing apart mountains to get these bones out to make a name for themselves. Then it sort of tapers off, and you have, like, these TV personalities like Curie, Bakker, Horner. And then you have, like, the new breed, which I don't know why I'm saying that because I sound stupid. But like, I remember the first time I saw Paul Sereno in a documentary, and I'm like, whoa, this guy's got an earring? That is far out. And even to a lesser extent, like Mark Norell, and he's, you know, going out to the Mongolian desert and laying around in short shorts, pulling out Protoceratops skeletons or whatever. And now it's just sort of you know, tapered away to everybody is equal. There's no celebrity worship like there was in the old days.
Yeah, I mean, like, maybe that'll still happen, right? I mean, maybe we just don't know who those people will be yet, but I kind of like it this way. I mean, I think there's more room for more different kinds of voices out there, right? And like, more non-Western perspectives, more like, I mean, I have colleagues all over the world, and everyone's doing great, interesting work. And it's just nice to be able to keep up with all of that all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's amazing. I mean, even you are no stranger to documentaries and such, because as I was doing a little research about you for this, I saw how many things you have been credited in, and even one that I just recently bought for my nephew, the Walking with Dinosaurs feature.
Oh yeah, that was great fun.
Yeah, so I mean, even people that the average person on the street, even if you haven't heard of the paleontologist in question, you can almost guarantee they've been involved in something.
It's true. Yeah.
Because the Discovery Channel is constantly pumping out stuff about dinosaurs. There's always dinosaurs on the brain. And I probably should have done that before immediately talking to you, because I was like, oh, crap, she's been all over the TV. And it kind of froze me up. But it just goes to show you there are so many people out there who have so much expertise in so many different fields. It's hard to point to one and be like, that's the person who's going to lead it forward. Because I can't think of anyone off the top of my head who is coming out and just has a wide breadth but a very shallow pool of knowledge, as opposed to people like you who have a very deep, specific niche to fill.
Right, yeah. And I mean, I think that's okay. Like, that's kind of how science works, so
yeah.
It's not necessarily bad for things to have shifted in that direction.
I think everything that's going on is great. I think your work is great.
Aww.
Can't get enough of it. I'm constantly, like, every time somebody brings up dinosaurs, I'm very quick to bring up Zool, simply because it's such a perfect cultural touchstone for the average person to come to grips with.
Well, I'm really glad that it connected with people so much. I mean, like, I love that an ankylosaur was popular for its 15 minutes of fame. I mean, they're cool dinosaurs. There's some cool stories to tell about ankylosaurs that you can't tell with other dinosaurs. And Zool is an amazing specimen. And Zool's story is going to keep going, too, because we're doing all this great work. Like, we still have to describe all the other dinosaurs that were found with it and describe its ecosystem and how it died, how it came to be preserved the way it is, and hopefully find some of these ancient proteins in it, too. So, I mean, there's still just, like, tons to do on this specimen. So it's not the last you guys will hear about Zool, that's for sure.
It's got that pop culture appeal, because, like, as soon as Zool came out, and then that artist, the paleo artist rendition of the sort of the green and yellow.
Oh, yeah, that's Danielle Dufault. She's our resident paleo artist at the ROM, and she is amazing. So,
yeah,
it's perfect.
Wonderful stuff. I mean, the turnaround time that you've gotten on Zool has been really something.
Yeah, it's still, like, it's still kind of popping up every now and then, which is pretty amazing, so... Yeah, it's been a lot of fun, and there's still, like I said, still lots more science to do on it, so.
Yeah, I only hope that it continues as quickly, if not quicker, and the discoveries keep coming.
Well, we'll do our best. Some of it's really hard, though, so we'll see how it goes.
Please hurry, I've got so many questions. Oh, man. But, well, Victoria, thank you so much for appearing on the show.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. It's been really fun.
Yeah, I every time I have a paleontologist on, it gets me a little more comfortable, a little less starstruck, and honestly, the honorary PhD bestowed upon me by Andy Farkey really helped as far as that's concerned. So, Victoria, where can people find you? Obviously, you're on Twitter.
Yeah, there's a couple of places. So Twitter is a good place. So I'm just at Victoria Arbor. That's a great place to follow sort of like what's going on day to day with ankylosaurs, I guess. And I retweet lots of other cool science stuff, too. I also have a blog that has a difficult to spell name, which I probably should have thought of before I did. It is pseudoplocephalus.com. So yes. Maybe we can include it written down somewhere, in here.
I'll definitely put it in the show notes, because when I pulled it up, and I was like, pseudoplocephalus? How?
It made sense, in 2010 when I started it. But anyway.
Before moving on, I really want to know a little more about this name. So pseudoplocephalus, at first glance, I thought, okay, it looked like a fake Diplodocus at first. So break down what we got here.
The joke is, okay, so some of the work that I did as a grad student was untangling the diversity represented by what we called euoplocephalus. So euoplocephalus is an ankylosaur from Alberta. It's really what most of the toys that are called ankylosaurs are modeled off of. But what I found was that what we were calling euoplocephalus was actually four different species. So it had been way lumped, and it made sense at the time, but it was time to pull it apart. And so it became a bit of a running joke about whether or not something was a euoplocephalus, which means true, true, well-armored head, versus a pseudoplocephalus. Which would be false armored head. And so it really was just a goofy joke, but I thought it was a good name for a blog. And then I was like, maybe it wasn't, but I like it. I'm going to double down on it. It's a good.
The story makes it. So, I mean, that should, the story should be somewhere on the landing page of the, thing.
I think I have my colleague Mike Burns to credit for that one. He also works on ankylosaurs, and we've joked a lot about ankylosaur problems over the years, and so I think that was where that came from.
Yeah, and it's a really, I mean, all of these blogs I find endlessly fascinating, so maybe I'm not the best target audience to be espousing the merit of it, but I mean, there's so much going on all the time, it and this is gonna have to be one of my bookmarks from now on. Yeah, I will definitely link to all of your stuff. So don't worry about learning how to spell it.
Yeah, no, yes, that's probably for the best. Anyway, so that's my blog where I do updates about what we've been doing in the field and different research projects. And I've also got some more notes about ankylosaurs and some of the courses, online courses I've been involved in creating, and all kinds of cool reference, cool sort of resources like that. You can also find papers and links to papers if you want to read anything for yourself. And then I should also plug the Royal Ontario Museum's website, All About Zool, which we helped develop. And so I can also, well, maybe we can have that in the notes as well, but it's rom.on.ca/Zool. And that's got all kinds of great information. It's got 3D models of the head that you can spin around, and lots a great big photo gallery with all kinds of cool photos that you might not have seen before, and information about Zool. And we'll try to update things with a blog there as we prepare fossils and do all kinds of cool new research projects. And then if you're interested in following along with research at the ROM, they have a great Twitter account, @ROMToronto, and there's also a paleo-specific one called @ROMPaleo, but spelled the Canadian way with the extra A in it. So, yeah, okay. the proper way.
Yeah, I follow both of those, and they're both great.
Yeah, they're really great. And then if you want to keep in touch with Zool, we try to use the hashtag DinoZool when we're talking about Zool-specific stuff.
That's awesome.
So I think that's probably enough things for me to plug, I suppose, right there. But that should give you people lots of things to go read up on after they've listened to this podcast.
Yeah, and there's so much, and I recommend it all because it's really great. So once again, Victoria, thank you so much. I can't believe that I was able to get a celebrity of the paleontological world.
thank you. I'm not quite sure I agree with that assessment, but oh, I appreciate
trust me.
It. So.
From this side, you're nailing it. Like, there's so much great stuff going on. And I some of the people I follow are just relentless retweeters of other people. You're one of the great ones that are actually putting out, like, oh, here's what I did today. And it's not just a retweet of somebody else.
Well, we try. We're going out in the field soon, too. So we'll try to tweet from the field in Alberta, and we'll go down and visit the Zool Quarry. So stay tuned. So hopefully we'll have some fun things to show off in a couple of weeks.
Awesome. Well, I will link to all of that in the show notes. And guys, thanks for listening to another, you know, of the ongoing non-numbered paleontological interviews. probably have many more. And Victoria, please, if something big does come up, I would like you back. If something big happens, or even if you're not involved and you just want to talk about it with someone, I am always here, and I will force every one of my listeners in on the conversation.
Okay, that sounds good.
Oh, boy. So, once again, thanks, guys, for listening, and we'll see you next time for another one of these special dinosaur shows that I know you love so much. We'll see you next time.
Fistful of Podcasts Radio.